The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because we're lazy,
but because they are ours. We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements for tonight. We're on the 60-minute program, so do pay attention to the clock if you want to get an email in or a phone call into our guest, Clay Mowry. Make sure you follow the time and do it while we're still on air. That would always help. And one other thing, you might hear wind howling through my microphone. So we are having a windstorm in the Las Vegas desert. I know other parts of the country are having other kinds of bad weather. Ours is wind. And we have been advised that there may be power outages all over the desert area as wind blows the power lines down. Some of the wind gusts are up to 55 and 60 miles an hour. So if we go dead suddenly, the wind has taken us down. And we will reschedule the program with our guest tonight. But that's just a little heads up in case we suddenly disappear and you're wondering if it's my computers or your computer. It's the wind and the power lines in Las Vegas. Again, 60-minute format for tonight. Our toll-free is 866-687-7223. Remember that we have a newsletter that goes out at 6 a.m. Pacific time every Monday. If you want to get that show information, make sure I have your email address. Everything we do is archived and uploaded as soon as possible, although sometimes we drag on the summaries, but at least the MP3s and the podcast are playing. We do have a Space Shell store that may interest you with logo wear. Make sure you click on the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show. That's your access to our Space Shell store. And then a couple of other real important things. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, as most of you know. We fundraise on every show because the Space Show is an expensive show to run, and we are listener-supported. So we need your financial support to keep the Space Show going. As a nonprofit, you do get a write-off on the federal tax return if you're paying federal taxes. We are now, a Nevada corporation. So it took a long time to accomplish that between two bureaucracies. But so we're a federal 501c3, and we are a Nevada nonprofit corporation as of now. So if you're looking for the state deduction for your contribution, either just do it and hope nothing happens or find out in advance if your state recognizes other state nonprofits. I don't know the answer to that. Some do, some don't. But I urge you to check on that if it's important. But you can always support us through PayPal. We have a large PayPal button at the top of our homepage, or actually it's in the upper right of our homepage. As I said, that's the easiest way. We do work with Zelle all the time. Those of you who use Zelle know what it is. And the email address you would use to donate with Zelle is david@giantleapfoundation.org. Make sure you use that email address if you're using Zelle. And then, of course, our mailing address in Las Vegas is on the PayPal button, plus it's on our website. Easy to find. If you need help to find our mailing address, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And if you are using a check and putting it in the mail, cross your fingers that we will get it, but make the check out to One Giant Leap Foundation. And we thank you very much for that support. Don't forget, we have sponsors, and we have billboard advertisers, and you can be either one of those. Our sponsors are Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Ben Arroyo with his two books on developing the moon and lunar habitat development. Remember, if you buy those books off of the banner ads that Chaim Ben Arroyo has running on our webpage, you get a you help the space show because Amazon puts a little bit of your purchase price into a donation to the space show. So we thank Amazon for that, and we thank you for your support. You too can be a sponsor or a donor. You get the billboard, you get the banner ad running across the homepage. On the longer shows, you get a little message that we read that you write about your company or your activities. And on the shorter shows, we shout out like we just did. Email me if you're interested, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. We go back in time a little bit with our guest tonight, and we are very much in the real-time present with our guest. It's an opportunity we don't get with many Space Show guests, but we do with Clay Mowry. So Clay was first a guest on the show August 2nd, 2010, and at the time, he was head of Ariane Space in the United States. And I met Clay at a space conference. I don't remember which one it was. He did come on the show, and we've actually done multiple programs together. But we lost track for several years, which is what usually happens. And he is back now. And Clay has been in this industry for over 30 years. And I'm talking about commercial launch and satellite sectors, serving the government as a leader of an industry trade association, as a senior exec for leading space companies. He joined Voyager Space, that all of you know about, in January of 2022 as their chief revenue officer and is responsible for growing sales, aligning operating company product service offerings, developing analytics, setting strategy, and delivering customer success. Before, he was VP of Global Sales at Blue Origin, and then his bio goes all the way back to, as I said, running America Ariane Space, which is when I met him. And I assure you, the issues we talked about when he was with Ariane Space back in 2010 are nothing like what we're going to talk about tonight. In fact, you wouldn't think we're talking about the same industry. Clay, welcome back to the show after many, many years of absence. It's good to talk to you again. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Thank you, David, for having me back. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you tonight.
As I said while we were getting ready to go live, seldom do I get a chance to talk to someone who has evolved and grown and changed jobs and moved on as the industry has developed. So back in 2010, commercial launch, you know, it was big government companies are commercial companies. They have stockholders and all of that, although the launches and the rockets were really controlled by the government. There was no industry, not even close to today, and there was no real true concept of private space stations. And now you're with a company that's working on one. Talk about your 30-plus years and what you have seen and what shocked you and what surprised you and what the growth and evolution has been like from your point of view going through it with different companies and, you know, different game plans and watching everything change and trying to stay on top of the changes. Sometimes those changes happen really damn fast.
They do. They do. First of all, I've had a wonderful career, and it's hard to believe I've been doing this for 30 years. I still get up every morning and can't believe I work in this amazing industry. I tell people all the time that this is the most exciting time in space. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, since the 90s, and it's just extraordinary to me. You know, the growth, the amount of private investment, and capital that's coming into the business, the amount of public recognition. Everybody knows, what's going on in the space sector now. When when I go out and talk with people, Blue Origin and SpaceX and everything that's going on with the space station, it's really in the public consciousness these days. I mean, the awareness is incredible. But it's been an amazing transformation. I used to head up an organization a long time ago, the Society of Satellite Professionals International, which is now, I think, the Society of Space Professionals, or the Space and Satellite Professionals, I think is what it's called now. And I remember going to some of my very first meetings back when I was working at the Commerce Department, as a launch industry analyst. And I would show up with my friend Patricia Cooper, and we'd go to some of these events, and boy, did we feel like young pups at that point. And, the folks that were there were, shuttle and Apollo era people, and we felt like really kind of fish out of water. And I don't know if it's the same now when I go to some of these events, because I do a lot of work mentoring the young professionals. But just this past week, I spoke to a group at Georgetown University, kind of told them the story of my career and how I got started. And it was amazing for me to see the interest, because I doubt I could have spoke to a group of students like that, 10 or even 20 years ago, that you would have get the turnout and the interest that we see in the space sector today. And I guess to your point, 13 years ago, last time we spoke on the show, the commercial launch sector was nothing like it looks like today. And this idea of a commercial space station, was also, I think, a really a foreign concept, right? Like, it really wasn't something that anyone considered. But if you look at the evolution of how we're going towards what, a lot of people describe as buying space as a service, we really come a long way. And a lot of that is due to, commercial orbital transportation program, the COTS program that NASA ran, commercial crew and commercial cargo programs, CRS and CRS-2, and the commercial crew programs that, Phil McAllister and other folks at NASA started. And it's incredible now to see that the evolution of that is now for NASA to hand over low Earth orbit, basically, in this commercial destinations free flyer program to us to build, design, build, and then launch a space station with some of these incredible, we're looking at some of these incredible new launch systems, and be able to privatize that and actually make it work. And I think the evolution from government owned and operated to commercially owned and operated is something that it's about time. But boy, it's taken a while to get there, right, for these programs.
Absolutely. One of the things I like to look at and talk about is the non-space industry that had to develop at least at the same pace, if not at a faster pace, to make some of this happen. Because the technologies that are being used today, many of them, including some of the materials, weren't around in 2010. Mm-hmm. So you had non-space industry that had to come along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, material sciences is the heart of a lot of these things, and particularly when you deal with space, right? Metallurgy and microelectronics, obviously additive manufacturing is playing a huge role in what we're doing now, 3D printed rocket engines and parts and even whole vehicles. I would say that the another huge change here is that, mass to orbit, when you think about things like New Glenn, Blue Origin's rocket in development, or Starship, down on the pad, they're trying to get this thing off here soon with SpaceX. It really changes how you think about what you can build and what you can fly. And mass, which used to be I've been a launch guy for 20-plus years. I think in terms of mass, right? Satellite guys think in terms of power. I think in terms of mass to orbit, and what does that take, and what's the delta be to get to where you need to go. And so a lot of that thinking is really turned upside down now. You talk about these really large vehicles where it becomes more volume, in fact, than it is mass to orbit. And you really think about a lot of different things you can do. And I really feel like, and I know I've been saying this for probably two decades, we're on the cusp with some of the orbital servicing type systems now. If some of these things, and Northrop Grumman did an amazing job with their MED, there's some of these other programs and systems that come online, and we really get to this point where we have capable vehicles, space tuggers, if you will, right? I always joke the answer to every question, every hard question in space is the answer is space tug. if we have these capabilities, you know, it really does change the game. And so, yeah, to your point, a lot of these new technologies and capabilities, things that weren't thought of before or even dreamed of, are now becoming a reality with heavy lift and all the other industries that have developed around this that allow us to do things and manufacture things in a completely different way.
From your perspective, how well has, that's probably the wrong grammar, but how well have the regulations and the regulatory government side of things kept up with this, or have they kept up with it, or is it being outpaced and too bad for the government regulatory side?
You know, I'll say this as somebody working in the government and who worked on regulatory policy for many, many years. I'm still involved, obviously, in a lot of it because we have to abide by and comply with a lot of those regulations. Regulations will always take more time than technology development. Technology will always outpace the regulatory environment and sometimes speed by, and then it's got to, you know, the regulatory guys have to catch up and do the best that they can. And they do try, but, you know, the pace of technological change is such that you're always going to see technologies outpace the policy or the regulation that exists, and it takes some time. I did a stint the past few years on the Comstock group at the FAA, and that was an interesting piece of or time to work in it, trying to achieve some regulatory reform on launch licensing. And I think we did some good work there, and they're making some great progress to try to achieve that. But it's always going to be a little bit behind. But same thing with law. You know, it takes a while to get laws in place that allow things to take place. But by and large, the government does, I think, by and large, do a good job of trying to accommodate industry, of trying to allow industry to thrive. And, you know, in the U.S., I think we take probably a leadership role in this area, and one that's probably a little bit more open-minded than the rest of the world, right, where you've got even more restrictive policies, laws, and regulations in place that seek to protect certain, you know, government sectors or industry sectors. So I think for us, you know, we're probably on the forefront of that here in the U.S.
Listener Todd in San Diego has an email for you, and he said, I'm curious how you see the development, R&D, and advancement of space manufacturing, specifically on orbit manufacturing, people wanting tourism and hotels and space settlement to proceed faster and faster than it is, are a little bit taken back by the fact that manufacturing and on-orbit construction seems to be a little bit slower than tech development and some other aspects of commercial space. What are your thoughts on space manufacturing and orbital manufacturing?
You know, I think some of the things we're talking about today, you couldn't even have thought of 10 years ago in terms of what you could do in orbit with, say, 3D printing. And we've come a long way with a lot of these technologies, but it's still a hard thing to do, right? And while certain technologies have been demonstrated in orbit for 3D printing, there's a ways to go with respect to, you know, metal. And what can you do? We did a Nanorax, one of our operating companies at Voyager, did some work recently with a mission that they flew on a SpaceX upper stage where they did an experiment to cut metal in space in zero gravity and see how that would work. And there's quite a bit of work. And by the way, it was successful. The data, we didn't get all the data set we wanted coming with the vehicle. But, you know, we were able to show that we can do it. We could cut the metal in space. I think there's a lot of work still to be done on how to define and operate effectively with 3D printing with metal in orbit. And that will unlock a lot of capability. There's a number of companies I've been talking to recently as part of our, you know, Starlab space station, where they want to come with the vehicles, say, you know, an HTVX by Mitsubishi or a Cygnus from Northrop Grumman or a space rider that ESA is developing. And they want to use these systems to dock. You can set up something inside the system, undock it, do the manufacturing, bring it back to the space station, and then deorbit the finished product. Because some of these systems, some are available, but others are not, right? Some of these are cargo up, and then they burn up on reentry. And so I think there's a lot of thought going into how would you set up a system for manufacturing in one of these vehicles. And by the way, it's not always great to have the manufacturing in the same place you might be doing delicate science. So it's something we're cognizant of as we design StarLab. Having a factory and a research laboratory next to each other, vibrations, acoustics, other kinds of things might not be the greatest place for one to go with the other if you're trying to have a really sensitive and refined environment. So it's one of the things we're looking at. But these visiting vehicles, I think, offer a really interesting capability to come and then even manipulate something if you needed human interaction with it and then to get it down, do the down mass. So I think there's a lot of promise there. There's a lot of work to do because manufacturing here on Earth is very different. And ISRU, I think, is, again, on the cusp. I think we're really going to start to see some progress, I think, in the next few years with a number of the CLPS landers and other landing systems on the lunar surface where we can start to take lunar regolith, hopefully find, and extract water from the south pole of the moon and start to do things and manipulate that. But we've got a road to go. Maybe in some of these cases, a longer road than we'd like, because it does take a bit to figure out how to manipulate those systems in zero gravity or even in a lunar gravity with 1/6 Earth's gravity. But I think we're on the road to start to look at that and figure out how to. Really, the secret, I think, is living and working in space. Right, this is what we've got to figure out if we want to be. Extra planet or extraterrestrial, and take humans, whether you're an alien and see free floating colonies or you're more of a planetary chauvinist as Carl Sagan, some of the guys said, or Gerard O'Neill said that, some of us think of the planets as the ultimate destination. Other people think of free flyers. But if we're going to do either or, in 1/3 gravity, in microgravity, in 1/6 gravity, we have to figure out how to build things there. And so we're on the front of that end. But, what was science fiction just 10, 15 years ago is now, I think, a reality that's coming. And there's a lot of companies that are working on how to solve that issue.
You have a note from the other side of the country that's actually a follow-on to Todd's note. So Holly is in Boston, and she said to do all of these grand things, there's going to be an awful lot of power needed to be created mm-hmm. in space. How are we doing on delivering cost-effective power and minimizing the power requirements of equipment that may be developed to do what you're talking about?
Well, that's a good question, Holly. I think, there's a bunch of things going on there, but let me give you one example with our StarLab space station. We're actually talking actively now to several companies about how they can provide us with a power propulsion element that could generate 60 kilowatts of power to power our system up there. And I can remember when 20 kilowatts of power for a big GEOCOMSAT was a big deal. And now we're talking three times that amount of power to run experiments and all the systems that we want. You can think about edge computing even up in the space station and power requirements for that as well. So while we can be a lot more efficient in some ways in terms of what we're running, power still is a limiting factor. The good news is we've got 24/7, more or less, not always, but close to 24/7 solar up there as we're orbiting, and we can generate a heck of a lot of power and even store some of that power and use it to our advantage. But there, and then there's a whole new sector that NASA's working and Department of Energy and others about could we have nuclear powered capabilities in space. That's a much touchier subject, of course, politically and otherwise, but I think it's something we need to actually move towards. My personal opinion is something we need to study and figure out how we can do safely and effectively.
So before I take you to your phone call, for a
sure.
private company to use RTGs, that's not possible
yep.
today, is that correct?
Well, I think the problem is getting it all licensed and orbited, right? There's a number of issues there that are kind of fraught with regulatory and safety.
So it's not on your table for your space station.
No, what we're looking at right now is solar powered systems and batteries to do the power for StarLab, and we think there's and by the way, our drive here is to get a space station in orbit as quickly as we can. The NASA's made the decision to deorbit the space station. By 2030, we're in a bit of a race now, if you will,
right.
To put StarLab in orbit as fast as we can. And so We want to do this as quickly as possible with a capable product. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel in building a space station, but we do think that a purpose-built space station that's designed and constructed efficiently, you know, the station we have now, of course, has been up there for 20 plus years. It's, wasn't originally designed as a super functioning laboratory that kind of backed into some of that capability. And we think with, particularly with a structure that we're building, an 8-meter, habitat laboratory, that, we can do some things that, are very efficient, and capable. You know, the other issue, as your listeners probably are aware, when you generate a lot of power, then you gotta deal with the heat and radiating that heat. So that's the other piece of that. The more power you generate, you gotta make sure that you're, from a temperature standpoint, we're keeping the electronics in the power propulsion element in the station at a certain level. And so, with great power comes great radiators. Let me put it that way. I'm going to paraphrase Spider-Man there.
By the way, I just got a note and said, David, if you had held this show for a walk through time with Clay for 12 shows, he would have been your 4,000th guest. Instead, he's number 3,988, and nobody in hell will ever remember 3,988, but people might remember 4,000. So, you know, if I thought about it, I would have booked you for the 4,000th show, but I didn't think about it. Let's see who your caller is. Welcome to the program tonight, caller. Who are you and where are you, please? Caller? He's still there because the line isn't disconnected.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is David from Austin, Texas.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
It's great to hear you. On power, I know you're dealing with a space station, so you have solar 24/7. Are you dealing at all with surface power on... say the lunar night, which is 14 days, or the long, cold Martian winter nights? Or is that someone else's problem at this point? Because I know the Chinese rover just passed away on Mars, and there's, even for robots, it seems like lasting the night is pretty hard on the surface. And obviously for humans, that's absolutely critical. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and we do think about it. I don't think about it with respect to Starlab and the station, but we've got a couple of other. So Voyager has 6 operating companies, and one of them named Pioneer Astronautics, which is Bob Zubrin's. He founded that company and runs it. We do a lot of work on ISRU. And Bob's come up with some ideas and concepts about rovers that could actually be fast enough to be in the sunlight and then get back into the, you know, survive the nights and be able to get scamp back and get power generated. But it's certainly an issue, right? And one of the other technologies we've been working on with them is dust tolerant coatings, right? That you could coat with the solar arrays so that the rays that you did have when you did have a power generating capability, right? The ability to make solar power there. That the dust generated on the lunar surface from doing work wouldn't coat your solar arrays and then degrade your power generation capabilities. So we think about those things, and we're, by the way, hopefully going to test some of that dust-tolerant coating capability on some upcoming missions where we want to make sure that the dust, not only for power generation, but, you know, for anything that's a moving part up there, we think that, you know, keeping dust off and allowing the systems to move and operate efficiently it's a huge issue, but you're absolutely right. It's one of the big things a lot of people think about in terms of solar generation power. If you're going to have nuclear power up there, or do you have the battery systems that can survive those long nights? And that's going to be a critical capability to be able to work there in the South Pole.
And if you did have either nuclear or space-based solar or something, or huge amount of batteries, something continuous, could you just have your rovers go in and plug in time to time, or is it more complicated than that?
I'm not understanding the question, but you certainly you have to be able to build a system in a way, right, that you could survive those long nights, right? So either it's either an issue of battery or power generation. Well,
I mean, if you had like a base that had power,
yep.
Did you just go to it and come back, or would that like not be? Would that not work for any of the things you're doing?
Certainly could for a number of the applications. Yeah, having a base there, if you had nuclear or if you had battery powered, solar generation with batteries, you absolutely could do that.
Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Clay, did you even think of such things 30 years ago?
No. No, I pinch myself, David, every morning I get up and I'm trying to build a commercial space station. I can't believe it, really. It's a wonderful time to work in this business. And I know everybody wishes that the pace of it was faster, but, I think that actually things are really progressing. Compared to the beginning of my industry, things are moving almost tripled the speed that they used to, right?
How much, let me rephrase it. Are the cash flows needed for all of this R&D coming in large quantities? Are they being reduced by our economic conditions, high interest rates? What's your assessment of the ability to continue attracting cash? And, I listen to the business news and the economic news, and I hear interest rates will keep rising for all of 2023, and this will be a recession. Maybe it'll be a light recession. The usual crap that everybody's hearing. How is this reflected in the cash flows needed for this really great innovative space R&D work?
Well, if you follow it along, and there's a number of reports out there. Hank Bryce on Space Tech does some of these reporting on this, but also some of the big firms on Wall Street, the Morgan Stanley's and Goldman Sachs and Seraphim and others report about the private capital inflows over the past several years. We've had record years. And even if you take out, the money that Elon's raised or that Jeff Bezos has spent with Blue, there's still record amounts of private capital that have been flowing in. Is it impacted by the larger economic situation? Yes. It's been a little bit different. And by the way, we have this whole phenomena of the SPACs, the special purpose acquisition corporations that maybe had some impact, there because they've struggled. It's not a fast return business necessarily with space. You need a longer time horizon. And so I think we've probably seen, while there's still some SPACs taking place and some of that capital still flowing into the business, I think we're going to see that settle down a bit. Largely, are we still able to raise money? Yes. And a lot of smart money will flow to companies that have clear, defined business plans and a path, to free cash flow and profitability. And I think, I know with our company, we're well situated for that. And we think that there's an appetite out there to raise more capital. So it's a challenge, I think, broadly, right, to get people, A, to understand how to invest in space, and B, the kind of horizons and timeline you need to get the return on that invested capital. It's not a business where you're going to see super rapid, quick returns. You have to be patient with the capital invested. But I do think there's investors that understand that time horizon and are willing to take a longer view.
I do follow some of the ETFs that specialize in space, and they're about 10 points off their record highs, maybe 12 points off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're floating in that neighborhood. They don't seem to get too excited either way. So that's a reflection of how the companies that are in their index are doing. So I think it might be easier to raise money for a not public venture than it is to raise one that's already out there and has a stock trading price. Do you sort of think that's true?
I don't know that I've done that analysis. It's an interesting take. I think maybe there's some truth there. I haven't looked at it closely enough. I think a lot of that's dependent on the technology and the capability, right? That you're trying to provide, or the problem you're trying to solve for. Right? I think most good businesses come with a proposition where they're solving a problem or building something to a use case that needs to be built. And so if you've got a good value proposition, I think whether, you know, whatever your approach is, I think it's going to be investable. Yeah. So, but yeah, it'd be an interesting case to take a look at it, to do some comparison in that sector.
It'd be a good business school paper if somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Listeners, you can call us. We still have time. And the toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And you can also continue to email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Jerry in Tucson says, you mentioned earlier you are in a race for a private space station. How many viable entities are there? Are they all American entities? Are there any viable contenders from another country, and which country would that be? And are you leading, or do you think we might see 4 or 5 private stations deploy around the same time?
Thanks, Jerry. I couldn't have asked a better question, so appreciate it. So in the commercial destination free flyer segment, where Starlab is positioned, there's three companies that received awards. We Nanorax, which is one of our operating companies, and Voyager received the largest award under a Space Act agreement with NASA for $160 million to start designing and developing Starlab. Blue Origin and Sierra led program called Orbital Reef are also in that, north of Grumman as well. I don't think they have a name for their station. And then similarly, there's under, I think it's Appendix I of NASA's procurement, that Axiom has an award that where they get paid to provide data, and their model's a bit different. They're connected, or building modules that would be connected to the ISS, and then at some point in time they would detach from the ISS. The rest of us, the other three, are free flyer programs. And what NASA has said is they want a minimum of 2, I think. I'm trying to remember exactly how they phrase it, but they want 2 or multiple space stations, and we think 2 is probably, if you think about like CRS, what they did with originally with Cygnus and Dragon, I think they're looking for 2 systems up there. And then, of course, outside of the United States, so those are all American-led ventures. In fact, by the way, we, Voyager, signed an agreement with Airbus. We announced earlier this year, Airbus is helping us now on the design piece of Starlab, and we actually love that connection, that international partnership and connection, because we think it carries on the Western-led efforts for the ISS, and so it gives us the International Space Station, so it gives us connectivity back to the European Space Agency and European countries that have human space programs as well, and also payload research. So we're happy to be partnering with them. Even, you know, Starlab's still U.S.-led, U.S.-owned controlled, but to have Airbus as part of our team and the expertise they bring from designing the Columbus module, ATD, and SIHAB work they've been doing for ESA, that's all a great thing. Outside of the Western partners, you know, China has, I think it was in December that they started operation, Tiangong, their space station in orbit. And so China's absolutely up there. Russia has said they have some ideas about putting their own station outside of the ISS in orbit later this decade. I don't know the details of that or their intent at the end of the day, what the design piece of it would look like. India is developing a crewed system that they're looking to fly. They've got, I think, 6 more test flights to do to put people in orbit. But I think their station is still a long ways off. I think that's a decade or more out. I don't know if they've even released what the full plans would look like. But we think it's a good thing that India would have crew capability. And we have hoped that they would want to, you know, fly to our space station once it's what's in orbit. So it'll be interesting to see how that looks. And, you know, our Starlab program is designed for a single launch, which makes us a bit different than the others. You know, 7 or 8 meter diameter on the large Habitat Laboratory with this big, think of it as like a super size or super powerful GeoCompSat bus as our power propulsion and the docking module. We think that in that system, we can do a purpose-built space station first for, I'd say, focused on business where it relates to, let's say, professional astronauts, if you will. You know, the NASA, ESA, JAXA, Canadian, and other space agency astronauts, and also have room for some commercial. And as demand grows, we can do a Starlab 2 or even more using that same design and function, and launched on either any of the large launch systems that are out there. So a lot of room for growth. We think multiple space stations is the future in low Earth orbit. By the way, they don't all have to fly in 51.6, where the ISS is today, which was, I think, originally set upon because of access for the Russian launch systems. We can look at different orbits. I think the Chinese station, if I'm correct, flies around 40 degrees inclined, mid-inclination. So there's lots of places that you can fly that don't have to replicate the ISS orbit that's up there today.
You have another caller. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall in Renfro.
Yes, Marshall.
And my question is, once Starship successfully orbits or gets up to man-rated, will that totally change the design of future space stations? Or maybe it's something you've already put in the works already.
Yeah, I think, thanks for the question, Marshall. I think I would say the jury's still out on that. I think, first of all, I think Starship is a game changer. It's an incredible capability, and kudos to SpaceX for taking this on as something that they want to achieve and be able to launch 100 plus. And I think they even came out recently saying they could maybe even do more than 200 metric tons in an expendable mode. To Leo, it really is a game changer, and as I say, it changes kind of the paradigm about how you think about access to space. Same with New Glenn and its capability. Somewhat smaller vehicle, but still super impressive compared to what's been flying recently. So what does that mean? So when they have a crewed version of Starship, I think it'll be capable. I don't know the exact number of astronauts, but it could handle. But then you have to think about, for longer durations, what would that look like? Would it supplant space stations? I don't think so. I think space stations, purpose-built kind of platform, have their own design function, just like anything else. Cars don't replace trucks or mobile homes or campers. So, and then if you think about it from a research, depending on what your use case is, for the platform, there's certain capabilities and the economics that go along with those capabilities that won't obviate the need for that. So I think there's room for multiple players up there and multiple systems. I think Starship with a crew capability really will. Now you're not talking about flying up in a car. You're flying up in maybe a van or a minibus, right, depending on how many people they could take up at any given time. So that will change, I think, the economics, right, of accessing platforms in low Earth orbit, for tourism, for manufacturing, for, living and working in space. So it'll definitely change the economics. It'll take them a few years. I think, we hope to be orbiting and operating, well in advance. So we'll be looking at using Dragon and, hopefully CST-100 and Dream Chaser in a crewed version. And as I say, maybe even India will come with a capability. There's some other companies out there trying to develop human rated systems as well out there, starting with cargo, kind of the tried and true path, start with cargo and then get humans. So a couple of companies out there, I think, that could show some promise in that. So, yeah, I think it's great to see all that, right, because heretofore, as we said earlier in the show, that was the province and the purview of just giant space agencies and governments. It wasn't something that commercially everyone thought was viable. And now we've seen just a huge revolution in that part of the sector. And, it's super, I'm super happy and excited to see that. Yeah. It really is incredible.
My next key question, though, is when you cut the price in half, kilos to orbit cost, is that going to make more important than the size of the ship that you can send up?
All right, let me see if I can answer that. So first, let me just say, as somebody who worked in launch for 20 plus years, The price per kilogram to LEO and even to GTO is definitely down about 50-60%, depending on how you want to look at the analysis. I've written some papers on this with others, and we've done some analysis on price points, you know, with what you can glean in the sector. And that price per kilogram has dropped radically. Not as much, you know, some people would like to see it be one-tenth, and what does that mean? You know, launch, it's not the most elastic business in that, you know, a drop in that price. It definitely has increased the capability of what we can put into space. But really, I think volume as well as price, you know, and when you want to say price per kilo, which really means mass, volume is a big change, a big game changer. Maybe even as much, if I dare say it, and somebody will probably come back and write me a note, but I think volume is as much of a driver, if not even more of a driver here, because you can put so much. Before, it was hard to get to the mass limit of a vehicle. Now you can get there because of the incredible amount of volume. So let me use an example for you. If you're stacking Starlink satellites or Kuiper satellites, you can put a heck of a lot more spacecraft, right, into orbit in one launch than you could ever before. I tell this story a lot about when I was at Ariane Space. We were at a 4-meter, you know, 4.2-meter fairing on Ariane 4, and we decided with Ariane 5 we're going to go with a 5-meter fairing, and customers said, you know, nobody's going to fly with that. Everybody's building stuff for 4-meter fairings. Proton flies with a 4-meter, and Atlas and Delta and all these guys have 4-meter fairings. And lo and behold, as soon as we built a 5-meter, everybody else built a 5-meter. Why? Because nobody says, oh, I don't want that much volume, right? They're going to design to that larger volume just as people are designing the large volumes of New Glenn and Starship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to see that, and that's a really different way for you to think about what you could put inside one of these vessels. So, yeah, price per kilogram, sure, big driver. Volume equally as important, maybe even a bigger driver in terms of the kinds of things you can launch. And, again, I'll use Starlab as an example. We can envision a metallic 8-meter, 7-meter structure that right now, most of the elements that are flying up there are 4 meters, right, in diameter, 4.2 meters. At Thales Alenia Space built a great product in that area, which, you know, Cygnus is built on and the Columbus module and a lot of others in orbit. Now, do the basic math on that, you know, pi r squared, you're talking about 4x the volume with an 8-meter structure. So it really allows you to think about design differently than you could before in kind of more of the traditional 4-meter kind of volume.
I agree with you. I think the volume is probably 50% more important than the mass, but I'm very happy that you agree with me. Thank you very much. Until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Thanks for the question.
Bye. Listeners, there's still time if you want to give Clay a call, 866-687-7223. So I have a call from Bill in Omaha, and Bill says, given your private space station, how much more difficult and how much more costly would it cost to send it up as a mini O'Neill space structure for either a hotel or a settlement?
Okay, so first of all, you know, the space station that's operating today is about $100 billion. If you think about all the costs and launches and the elements that are up there, that's a huge price tag. We're talking about something that's a fraction, small fraction of that. I'm not going to give you the exact number because we're still in the design phase, but, you know, something that's far less than a tenth of the cost of putting up. And when I talk about Starlab, we're about 40% of the capability and by volume of what exists up there today, but we think of over 100% or even more than 100% of the payload capability. We think because of the way we're designing the structure and platform. Now, O'Neill colonies are something quite different, right? Much more grand, huge structures, depending on how fanciful you want to get to, or you can even go to something a little bit more simple like 2001 Space Odyssey kind of program, but It's let me go back to your point, which is, you know, we think about like a hotel in space, which was in fact modeled, right? I think it was Pan Am and Hilton,
right,
were the brand
ago,
that were featured in 2001. And how did we get started with Hilton? Well, we worked with them to bake a cookie in space, you know, the cookies that they gave the DoubleTree, you know, and we did that effectively on the ISS, and then they came back to us and said, hey, guys, what's next? And we said, well, you know, we just won this award to build a private station. How would you guys like to get involved with that and help us to design the interior of that for crew quarters and user experience? And they were thrilled by that idea. And it really goes back to Conrad Hilton in the 60s. And you know, they had envisioned ultimately putting a hotel in space. And they're super excited about the opportunity to do that. And you know, people think of Hilton as a hotel brand, but really a lot of what they do is about user experience, customer experience, cleanliness of rooms, fabrics, you know, surfaces, textures. How do they design things for a lot of wear and tear and use, right, by humans?
Right.
And particularly in the COVID world, they've learned a lot in that area. And so they're going to help us, I think, in a lot of ways to improve what that astronaut experience would look like and feel like and make that a much more hospitable, let's say, for space tourism environment as we move forward. So we're thrilled to be working with them. So, yeah, big volume structures, hotels in space, absolutely. I think we're starting to see that concept become a reality, and having brands like Hilton involved with us is exciting and help leading that way.
Could Starlab be a basic kindergarten model of that that actually took a few tourists or residents up there and didn't mind, you know, sort of a rough environment? Could it be a primer, a learning habitat?
Yeah. So I think, you know, our baseline for Starlab, obviously, the first use case is for research, right? That primarily that is our focus, to try to do scientific research, discovery, exploration, you know, and working not only for space agencies, but for companies and others that want to do microgravity research in orbit. And so that'll be our first use case. But we actually build into our business model as well the ability to serve the space tourism sector with astronauts that want to fly, or even space agencies that want to fly, but not, you know, for longer rotations with a lot of research. They're interested in gaining some experience, doing some experiments, but maybe not quite as longer term in flight. So absolutely, we're going to design for that. And we think that this 8-meter structure we're designing and the capability, you could do a lot of things in different configurations. So once you have a metallic shell that's built out, at that level, you can start thinking about a habitat and structure that are structured in like floors or in with like large, huge volume areas for floating around with green screens, with you know, more of a feel like what you see in some of the science fiction, right? If you are fans of The Expanse or other programming that's out there, it's not the you know, the restricted, you know, to that 4-meter kind of environment where you see people flying in a tube. You're talking about a much larger space for floating, observing, playing, gaming, whatever it is that these folks want to do in that environment. We think there's a huge amount of capability with a big volume structure that can open up some new markets, be it entertainment, gaming, or otherwise.
We're moving close on to the 60 minutes, but in the remaining time, first of all, listeners, there's still time if you want to call 866-687-7223. But given your hindsight, your 30 years plus of experience, do you dare venture for us to tell us what the industry will be like in 5 years and 10 years?
Well, sure. I think, I mean, in 10 years, it gets a little harder to see. The crystal ball always gets cloudier after 3 years, right? You can kind of predict 2-3 years out, but then after that, it gets started to get cloudy. So, but you know, 5 years from now, I think we're going to be on the cusp of orbiting private space stations out there. I think we'll have some very large, capable operational launch systems that are really changing the paradigm for lift. I think mass becomes less of an issue to get to orbit. I think we'll have demonstrated a lot of this in-orbit space tugs, if you will. I think will be prevalent and proven out and operational. I think we'll be on the front end of the in-orbit manufacturing place, but still probably some work to go to be doing full-fledged big manufacturing projects up there, but I think we're going to be on the front end of some technological capability and breakthrough, probably mostly looking at, you know, material property, advances in material property, manufacturing, zero gravity, I think we'll be, you know, back on the lunar surface in five plus years from now, and operating a lot of systems up there, and starting to make some real headway, getting people back to the moon, and starting to set up some real permanent bases and facilities there on the South Pole. In 10 years from now, in 5 years from now, we're going to have a heck of a lot of broadband capability in space, right, between Starlink and Kuiper and OneWeb and other systems up there. So I think the bandwidth and the pipe issue that we face in space, you know, difficulty, I look at this from a space station standpoint, the ability to get data up and down is going to be advanced dramatically with these constellations. I also think that edge computing will have made huge leaps in being able to do amazing things on orbit where we haven't had that kind of computing power in space before. And that has a whole host of applications, both from national security to civil to commercial, where it has advantages in that. 10 years out, I think we'll have, I think we'll be in a place where we have a permanent presence, on the lunar surface that, is really starting to make some major headway in terms of our ability to use and harness resources on the lunar surface. I think we'll have, multiple space stations in low Earth orbit. More than two or three, and purpose built for different capabilities, and that's going to be an exciting time. I'm hopeful that we'll have a number of human rated systems, capsules, and vehicles that will be flying people to and back from space safely. And the safely is really the important part, right? I think that's going to be a pretty nifty future, and I won't be, you know, I'll still be in my 60s there. I should be able to enjoy that future.
What about Mars? I didn't see you include being on Mars in 10 years.
You know, I think, I'm probably not the guy to ask about Mars. I'm not an expert on Mars, but I do think we will be further on the path there. Will we have humans on Mars in 10 years? I'm going to say probably not. Hopefully your callers won't beat me up on that one, but I think it's going to take a little bit longer to safely get humans to Mars. Elon, of course, is going to try to prove me wrong, so have at it.
You have another caller. This will be the last call of the program tonight. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
This is Doug from Redlands, California.
Go ahead.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, Clay. I just have a concern about, you know, on the ISS, there was all sorts of efforts to get commercial activities there, and the Inspector General made some pretty strong negative statements about, that it wasn't very successful. The CEO of Meta Space,
Rush.
I forget his name.
Rush.
Yeah, Rush, exactly. He said, you know, if we had to pay for the launch to get our stuff in there, he says the math wouldn't work out. But my concern is, you know, a lot of your discussion about who the customers would be, you mentioned different governments. And my concern is as the Starship with its significant capability, it's 100 passengers to LEO per launch, and they're developing a fleet, and being able to deliver 100 tons of payload to the lunar and Martian surface. I mean, now they're saying 150 tons. when we have that sort of capability coming online, hopefully, my concern is that the commercial LEO destinations are going to be requiring basically subsidies or usage from NASA, and there may be, I don't know, maybe $1 billion a year that cannot go to taking advantage of a Starship, but is going to utilize the commercial stations. Now, if commercial stations could be truly commercial and not have to, rely on government budgets, I'd be fine with that. But do you anticipate requiring government utilization for a long time?
So let me try to unpack that. There was a lot there. But so I think basically government is definitely a key customer for some of this. They will, I think, remain a key customer, but they're not the only customer, and they're certainly not, we've got plenty of growth here. Now, the ISS maybe is a good and a bad analog for some of this, right? It's a 23-year-old government-run laboratory in space that's not set up originally to be a functioning research laboratory that's a profit-making enterprise. So we're using a much different model as we look to approach this, and we're using a science park model. If you can go to, by the way, anyone who wants a primer on space stations, you can go to our StarLab microsite, and you can look at the history of space stations. And part of what we're trying to do here is think about how we utilize a space station platform. And we're using a science park model. We've got the George Washington Carver Science Park. We're actually working with Ohio State University. And the science park model is a proven model all around the world, right? There's science parks everywhere. In fact, we've been working with there's International Association of Science Parks. So working with researchers, R&D, laboratories, universities, companies to use those models. And that's how we believe we're going to really start to unlock some of the capabilities of a commercial space station. So, you know, there's different drivers. And, I this is a long conversation about, you know, why, what with NASA and how, what works on ISS and with CASIS and what doesn't work. But we think if we take a different approach and a science park approach with the right partnerships, we can do a lot in low Earth orbit. So, yes, will government funding be a part of that? Government funding is always a part of basic research. So I don't take that the wrong way, but I think there will always be fundamental and basic research that will be done, whether it's funded by universities, companies, or the government. You're going to see that as part of the model. But that's all a good thing. I don't see any, I guess I don't see it as an either or. Will there still be work done on the lunar surface? Absolutely. And there should be. And should we go to Mars? Absolutely. And we will. So all of those things, I think, together are not, you can't do one without doing the other. I think the access to space will drive down the cost, and that the capability of these stations will be, several fold what we have the capability on the ISS today. So it allows us to do a lot of things and think differently about how we'll utilize and monetize that science in LEO. But I think a lot of people think of this as kind of zero-sum game sometimes. They think, well, you know, there's only room for one of these systems, or this system is going to beat out all the others. None of the others exist. SpaceX is phenomenal in what they're doing now, but have you seen the other guys go out of business or not? You know, people want multiple launch systems, multiple capabilities. We need it for safety and other reasons. And there's plenty of lift out there now that's just being bought up because of the need for these LEO constellations to be deployed in low Earth orbit. And I think you're going to see the same types of things and same kinds of economics going on with private space stations, where you're going to see more demand function for that. And I think more competition in these systems is a good thing. We want to see more crew and cargo capability. So, systems can be purpose-built for different types of applications, different types of I'm a business development sales guy. I think about market segmentation and market differentiation, right? So people always want to commoditize whatever the product or service is. In a lot of these cases, you have to think about the use case, the market segmented in different ways for different use cases and applications, and then how are the different capabilities differentiated for customers? Because different customers look for different things in those segments. And so it's a way to say, there's going to be a lot of flowers blooming here in the future, and I don't see it as an either or, but it's all a good thing, I think, for the growth of the space sector.
I would just comment that research parks on Earth, I'm not sure if that's a good model, because they typically don't require $100 million transportation to get to the park, but the commercial LEO stations, you know, that would be like the price now for a Dragon. So, I just hope, I do believe it is sort of a zero-sum game in that NASA's budget just can't increase forever. And so decisions are going to have to be made in terms of where, you know, budgetary resources go. And I'm hopeful that the commercial LEO stations turn out to be very profitable and place minimal burden on governments to keep operating.
I can tell you that we are going to be a lot more efficient, right? Super efficient. The cost will come down. We can do more science for less dollars than what we're doing today, all right? And more astronauts for less dollars than what you're doing today. You take the space station budget today, it's like $3.5 billion, $4 billion. How many astronauts do they
from the western side, they send up 6 to 8. Do the back of the envelope math, and you get to a very high price per astronaut, right? And I'm positive that we can reduce that cost and price, and that we can do more science and research for less money. And by the way, that's what NASA's banking on here. That's exactly what they want to happen, and that's exactly what we saw with CRS and Commercial Crew, is that, you know, it can be competitive. You know, compare those to the numbers of what was the space shuttle, you know, depending on how you want to do the math, right? And capability to orbit. And that program, you know, was, I guess, roughly about $3.5 billion if you launched it once or if you launched it 6 times a year, right? It was a heck of a lot of money per launch, and the capability that was there. So I think we've made great strides. It is hard. It's going to take us some time to get there, but, and by the way, in the cost savings, they're going to be able to put into the Artemis program, and they're going to get to the moon and get going to Mars. So I think there's savings there, that can be applied. And I think it's also, by the way, fostering the development of a lot of these systems. I mean, we're going to take advantage of, for Dragon and Cygnus and other systems that have been designed, built, Dream Chaser and others, that capability that was developed under these kind of commercial programs. So, think about that government spending. It's unlocking a lot of capability and the promise of what that can bring on the commercial side. So, again, don't, I tell people all the time, try not to think about, you know, it's a good analog and a bad analog to think about the ISS as the, you know, if you use the framework and the numbers that you start with today, you're never going to get there. But when you start thinking about, well, what can we do and how can we do it more efficiently with a purpose-built system, taking advantage of some of these large, capable launch systems, absolutely, there's business and markets, and we can do it more effectively. So, maybe I'm the eternal optimist here, but I've seen a ton of progress in my 30 years, and I think there's a lot more to come in the next 10.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Clay, I'd ask you what we've missed, but we've missed a whole bunch of stuff that we just don't have the time to talk about. But I hope you'll come on again, and I'd love to have you back on far more often to talk about these things rather than wait 10, 15 years in between.
Yeah, let's try to make it not 10 years or 15 years later. Let's try to do it in like 3 or 4 years from now.
Yeah, but good luck with all of what you're doing. We're following it and staying in touch, and we'll check in with you for updates down the road. And it's really great to catch up with you again. And I don't know, do you go to ISDC meetings with National Space Society? Do you ever venture into that commercial world?
I've been to a couple of those. I probably go to 6 or 7 trade shows a year. We didn't even talk about it. I'm the president of the International Astronautical Federation. So,
I
do that. I'm on the IAC. We're doing a climate change conference, GLOC, in Norway this spring. I'll be down in Panama for a parliamentarians meeting. We have the spring meetings in Paris. So I tend to go to those. I go to symposium, satellite show, World Satellite Business Week, and some others. But, look, if I get invited to ISDC, I'll go, you know. So,
okay. We'll look forward to it. And I hope I meet up with you again, but for sure we'll talk again before another 10 years or 13 years goes by. So,
all right. Thanks.
Good
thanks
catching
for having
up.
Me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Listeners, that concludes our show with Clay Mowery. A walk in the past and 1-2 feet into the future. Amazing. Lots of history and experience that he brings to the table. Thank you all for your calls, for your emails. We have a Hotel Mars program tomorrow. Anatoly Zak is updating us on some of the developments with the Russian space program. And then on Friday, we also are back to, by the way, you know, we're back to normal, everybody. So Friday, we have a physicist from Germany, Dr. Heinrich Paas. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, P-A-S, but it has a little two dots above the A in German. I don't speak German, so I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly. But he has a terrific new book, and I've been reading it, and it's called The One, How an Ancient Idea Holds the Future of Physics. I assure you, you'll enjoy the show. I haven't talked to him yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. And then our friend Joe Carroll is back with us Sunday, but Joe wants to primarily talk about his ideas for orbital debris. Dr. Goswami on National Security Tuesday.
week from Friday, this Friday, Laura Montgomery, the attorney, is back on, and so it goes. So we're pretty booked up until the end of March, so stay with us, more to come. One more pitch for supporting the Space Show. If you like this program, you like guests like Clay Mallory, remember that we're listener-supported. We absolutely need your support for the Space Show to continue going. It does consume money. The expenses go up as inflation goes up. The phone lines go up. The Internet goes up. And we need your help. So PayPal is the easiest way to support us. There's a PayPal button link at the upper right corner of our homepage, spaceshow.com. We do Zelle, and you email to david@onegiantleapfoundation.org with Zelle. Or you can use a check made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to our Las Vegas address, which is on the PayPal button as well as on our homepage. But don't forget us. We do need your listener support, and we hope you will support us. And we appreciate your feedback about our show. We're open-minded, so if you have something negative to say, we'll hear it. There was a lot of phone noise tonight on the show. I suspect some of that is wind-driven with phone lines that feed the Internet system that I'm using with Cox Cable. But I do know with Marshall's phone, we had some noise on his phone line. It is a weak point of the Space Show, the phone lines for guests and the phone lines for callers. So we do the best we can with what we have. I know some of you bitch about it, and, I don't have anyone to go bitch about it to, so I just bitch in my sleep, I guess. But, yes, it is a problem. We are aware of it. We're telephone dependent, and I can't control the phone lines that the guests use nor the callers, and that is a problem. Plus, we're using Cox digital VoIP lines, and they're not the best in the world, but most of the time they're okay. That's about all I can say from that. If you heard howling in the background, no, it is not Pepper. It is the wind. My house is two-story, and boy, the wind is ripping through out there and howling just like in the movie. So I'm sure the microphone picked up a little bit of that. But fortunately, our power has held up. No wind has knocked down power lines, and we're still good to go. So again, if you can, please do support the Space Show. We do need your support, and we appreciate very much your support and your contributions. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about that. Just email me if you have them at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our next live show is Friday, but Hotel Mars tomorrow with Anatoly Zak. Everybody have a great week. We're young into the week, so there's a lot of week left. So have a great week, a safe week, a healthy week. Keep looking up, as always. Clay is gone, but good night from Clay, good night from David, and the Space Show. And as I said, keep looking up, always.